content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we are reading this week from the September 11, 2015 issue of the Week magazine, the main stories and how they were covered. Televised killings spark new debate on guns. What happened? The murder of two local TV journalists live on air in Roanoke, Virginia, last week reignited the national debate over whether America's epidemic of gun violence can be stemmed by any change in laws. WDBJ reporter Allison Parker, 24, and cameraman Adam Ward, 27, were shot dead by a disgruntled former colleague during an interview with a local Commerce Chamber leader. The shooter, former TV reporter Vester Lee Flanagan, used a cell phone to record the attack himself and uploaded the grisly video to social media before turning his Glock 9mm on himself. Parker's parents pledged to devote their lives to persuading lawmakers to tighten America's gun laws. Allison was our bright, shining light, said Andy Parker, and it was cruelly extinguished by yet another crazy person with a gun. Flanagan, 41, was fired from WDBJ in 2013 for disruptive behavior, one of several jobs he lost because of his volatile temper. In a rambling 23-page manifesto he faxed to ABC News shortly after the killings, Flanagan claimed he had faced years of discrimination and sexual harassment for being black and gay. He voiced his admiration of the 2007 Virginia Tech massacre and said his actions in Roanoke were partially in response to the church shooting in June of 9 black people by a white supremacist in Charleston, South Carolina. Flanagan bought a handgun legally 2 days after the Charleston attack. "I've been a human powder keg for a while," he wrote, "just waiting to go boom." What the editorial said: "This tragic shooting was yet another reminder that our gun laws are deeply irrational," said the Washington Post. "Firearms aren't noble instruments of freedom. They are killing machines that are tightly regulated by every other developed nation in the world. Yet our craven leaders refuse even to fix background check loopholes or to ban wholly unnecessary high-capacity magazines. Would these measures have prevented the Roanoke murders? Probably not, but they could prevent others." Gun control advocates always proffer the same thoughtless and knee-jerk solution, said NationalReview.com. Background checks are easily circumvented. Assault weapons account for only a tiny fraction of gun crime. And banning high-capacity magazines holding more than 10 rounds would make it harder for the law-abiding gun owners, who often shoot poorly under duress, to defend themselves. "If we want to tackle gun violence, we should start by reforming our broken mental health system. With 300 million firearms in private hands, no new law will keep a murderous madman from finding a weapon." What the columnist said: "Why isn't the media calling this a race crime?" asked Noah Rothman in CommentaryMagazine.com. "When the clearly disturbed Dylan Roof slaughtered 9 black parishioners in Charleston, there was a coordinated effort to downplay Roof's mental state so as to make him representative of a legion of Confederate flag-waving white racists. Yet Flanagan, who said he hated white people and especially echoed Roof's desire to start a race war, has been written off as a deluded nut acting alone. Why the double standard?" "It's a fallacy that nothing can be done," said Robert Spitzer in the New York Daily News. "Had Flanagan tried to buy a handgun in New York State, the story would likely have been very different. To get a permit, he'd have had to list his former employers and say whether he'd ever been fired or been treated for mental illness. He would also have had to provide four character references testifying to his mental soundness. Then a county judge would have made a final decision, possibly after a face-to-face interview. Were similar laws in place across the country, there'd be many fewer gun deaths. Liberals need to be honest about their intentions, said Jonathan Tobin in CommentaryMagazine.com. Gun control advocates often point to Australia, where gun deaths fell after a nationwide ban on semi-automatic weapons, followed by a mass confiscation. But liberals are never willing to follow through on that logic. If you really believe America has too many guns, stop pretending you'll be satisfied with background check laws or other half measures. Your real goal should be changing the Constitution to remove the right to bear arms. Why not admit it? And a second main story today, Obama's landmark move. President Obama unexpectedly announced this week that the nation's highest peak, Mount McKinley, would officially be renamed Denali as he began a three-day tour of Alaska to urge action on climate change. The mountain has been called Denali, an indigenous Athabascan word, meaning the high one by Native Alaskans for centuries. But Obama's executive order, made through the authority of the Interior Secretary, angered Republicans in Ohio, the birthplace of President William McKinley, after whom the peak was named. House Speaker John Boehner said he was deeply disappointed, and Ohio Governor John Kasich accused Obama of executive overreach. During his tour, Obama visited the melting Bear Glacier and delivered a stark speech in Anchorage, warning that rising oceans could submerge entire countries if carbon emissions weren't reduced. Climate change is no longer some far-off problem, said Obama. It is happening now. Poor President McKinley, said Jim Swift in WashingtonPost.com. Killed by an assassin's bullet in 1901, 6 months into his second term, the former Ohio governor was poorly remembered even before Obama stripped him of his mountain. Other than the now-defunct $500 bill, what does he have? Oh, please, said Jonathan Bernstein in BloombergView.com. McKinley never set foot in Alaska, and the mountain was only named after him because some gold prospector wanted to celebrate McKinley's support for the gold standard. Indeed, Alaskans of all stripes, including no less a partisan conservative than Sarah Palin, have welcomed the name change. Great. So Obama has renamed Denali, said Eric Holthouse in Slate.com. What the president didn't emphasize enough, Denali is losing its glaciers at a rapid clip. Obama's entire urgent climate change trip is a hypocritical stunt, coming in the wake of his decision to allow Royal Dutch Shell to drill for oil in Alaska's Chukchi Sea. Obama promised to lead on climate change. Now it turns out that bold action doesn't look so different from the status quo. Controversy of the week, Roanoke shooting, turning murder into a selfie. In one sad sense, there was nothing new about the recent fatal shootings of the two television journalists in Virginia, said Farhad Manju in the New York Times. The spectacle of angry gunmen murdering people in public has become sadly commonplace in the U.S., but the killings of reporter Allison Parker and cameraman Adam Ward in Roanoke last week came with a frightful twist. The shooter, Vester Lee Flanagan, carried out his cold-blooded double murder on live television as Parker conducted an interview for network WDBJ. while Flanagan simultaneously made a video of the killing on his smartphone. After fleeing the scene as police hunted for him, Flanagan, 41, uploaded the chilling video to Facebook and Twitter, and it went viral. A former TV reporter himself, he knew the first live selfie murder would instantly become international news, and he was already famous when police cornered him and he turned his handgun on himself. In staging his theatrical act of revenge against two former colleagues and the world, Flanagan was just a ruthless killer, said Ian Robinson in the Daily Telegraph. He wasn't just a ruthless killer. He was also a film director, actor, and soon-to-be grotesque celebrity. Like so many attention-seeking shooters before him, Flanagan was a classic injustice collector, said Dave Cullen in NewRepublic.com. In a manifesto he sent to ABC News after the shootings, he complained of suffering from discrimination at WDBJ because he was gay and black, saying haters had hounded and demeaned him at every turn. His accusations seemed dubious. His evidence of racism included colleagues using the word field and bringing watermelon into his station. And Flanagan had accused coworkers of racist slights at previous jobs. But collectors magnify petty injustices, and Flanagan quickly constructed a worldview of himself as victimized, bullied, discriminated, and disrespected. In the social media era, it was inevitable that a narcissistic killer would share his revenge with the world, said Callum Borchers in the Boston Globe. When people mount GoPros on their ski helmets, take selfies on roller coasters, and live tweet their weddings, why wouldn't criminals document themselves in the act? No one should be criticized for posting or watching that video, said Sam Biddle in Gawker.com. It's horrific, graphic, and gruesome, and it's important that everyone looks at it. Perhaps if Americans can see Parker and Ward being effortlessly slaughtered by a disgruntled former coworker with an easily obtained firearm, they will be jolted into doing something about gun violence. Actually, spreading those images could make things worse, said Leon Nefak in Slate.com. Shooting rampages, experts say, often lead to copycat attacks. And any media outlet or Twitter user who shared Flanagan's video encouraged people with revenge fantasies to imagine themselves in the killer's position. But it's becoming increasingly difficult to hide from such images, said Leonard Pitts Jr. in MiamiHerald.com. Flanagan carried out and curated his killings online like a PR campaign, complete with angry justifications, so that he instantly gained thousands of fascinated Twitter followers and got his snuff film posted to people's Facebook pages. Because we live cheek by jowl online, the video then showed up in other people's news feeds, where the autoplay feature revealed its horrors without even a click. Today, a killer can compel millions of people to watch and participate in his brutal actions, whether we like it or not. This, then, is Vester Flanagan's perverse triumph. He has made witnesses of us all. It was a good week for transparency after thousands of teens in Taiwan sparked a new fashion craze by posting selfies while wearing nothing but plastic shopping bags. Bags from 7-Eleven are particularly cool. It was a good week for Carly Fiorina after CNN announced that it is changing the eligibility rules for its September 16th Republican presidential debate to include more recent polling data, making it more likely that the former business executive, now in the top 10, will make that cut. It was a good week for getting a room. After an amorous German couple on a trip to Austria got in the back seat of their minivan to fool around and became so distracted that they didn't immediately realize that the van was rolling into a lake. As the van sank, the lovers barely escaped by climbing out of the windows and swimming to shore. It was a bad week for over-flossing after a Wisconsin woman suffered a severe infection in her artificial knee because her vigorous tooth cleaning regimen introduced bacteria from her mouth into her bloodstream. It was a bad week for the gold standard after hammer thrower Paweł Fajdek of Poland got very drunk celebrating his world championship at a competition in Beijing and used his gold medal to pay his taxi fare home. He felt some regrets the next morning. And it was a bad week for first impressions after a Chicago man accidentally sent naked selfies of himself to the company human resources manager who had just hired him, sparking a police investigation. My understanding is they've rescinded the offer of employment, the local police chief said. Our briefing page article today returns to the idea of the mass killings. It's called The Killing Contagion. America leads the war in mass shootings. Why? Are mass shootings becoming more common? Without a doubt, although their prevalence depends on how mass shootings are defined. A recent Harvard University analysis that combined FBI data with other statistics concluded that since 2011, the frequency of mass attacks has tripled. But the commonly used definition, at least four people shot dead in a public place, would exclude last week's shooting on live TV in Roanoke, Virginia, which left two dead and one injured, as well as last month's movie theater shooting in Lafayette, Louisiana, in which two were killed and nine survived gunshot wounds. Under a broader definition, including all shooting deaths of four or more people, USA Today counted 346 mass shootings over a 17-year period with 1,697 victims, about 20 a year. A still broader definition used by Shooting Tracker, a crowdsourced website, counts all attacks in which four or more people are shot, whether or not they're killed. In the first 239 days of this year, the site recorded 249 mass shootings. It's a bigger problem today than it was a decade ago, and it may be a bigger problem in the future, said University of Alabama criminal justice professor Adam Lankford, who just completed a study on mass shootings. How does the U.S. compare with other countries? We are by far the world leader in this gruesome category. Mass shootings do occur in other developed nations. The worst ever was in Norway in 2011 when far-right fanatic Anders Behring Breivik shot dead 67 people and killed 10 more with bombs. But they're much rarer. In his new study, Lankford found that while the U.S. accounts for just 5% of the global population, it has 31% of all public mass shootings in which at least four people are killed. The U.S. has five times the number of mass shootings as the next highest country on the list, the Philippines. Why? There are many factors, but the most obvious one is the U.S.'s unique gun culture. The U.S. easily has the most guns per capita of any country in the world. With an estimated 310 million guns in circulation, roughly one for every American, and lax gun laws in many states, it's not hard for delusional or vengeful people to procure a semi-automatic handgun or rifle. What drives the shooters? revenge over real or imagined slights, the desire for attention and fame, the delusions of mental illness all can play a role. Almost all mass shooters are male, and about 64% are white, 16% black, and 9% Asian, according to a Mother Jones study. Only 23% have been treated for mental illness. After studying dozens of mass shootings, Lankford concluded that the American dream itself may contribute to the frequency of these killings. Americans, he said, are told that with hard work, anyone can be wealthy and successful. When success fails to materialize and men find themselves on the margins of society, they feel cheated, emasculated, and hopeless. They are in real pain, Lankford says, but they're eager to blame that pain on those around them. Why do they turn to violence? Killing former colleagues, schoolmates, or groups of strangers in a final suicidal spasm serves not only as an act of revenge, but as a way of forcing the world to be aware of the killer's inner torment. These very public attacks also give the killer the fame that eluded him in his failed life. They fantasize about going out in a blaze of glory, says Lankford. In the U.S., he notes, fame is revered as an end unto itself, even when the notoriety is negative. So mass killings cause more mass killings? The evidence strongly points to that conclusion. Some researchers, in fact, believe the U.S. suffers from a contagion of these attacks. National news media attention is like a vector that reaches people who are vulnerable, said Arizona State University researcher Sherry Towers. These disaffected people can be infected by the attention other angry, disturbed people get by becoming mass killers. Before he shot dead 20 young children and 6 adults at Sandy Hook Elementary School in 2012, Adam Lanza created a 7-by-4-foot spreadsheet documenting the names, body counts, and weapons from previous mass murders. It sounded like a doctoral thesis, one law enforcement veteran said. Can anything be done? Many proposals have been made, including reducing the availability of guns and high-capacity magazines, and identifying and treating mentally ill people who are prone to violence. All the proposed solutions might reduce attacks to a modest degree, but all face strong political, legal, and logistical obstacles to being enacted. Lankford believes the viral contagion of mass shootings is now deeply embedded in a culture steeped in guns, fame, and alienated men, and is unlikely to abate anytime soon. It's the dark side of American exceptionalism, he says. And we take a look now at the columns. The first from the U.S., America's Fear of Immigrants. Donald Trump is hardly the first prominent American to fan the flames of anti-immigrant hysteria, said Catherine Ramble. The embarrassing truth is that the U.S. has always been hostile to immigrants, with a nativist tradition dating back to the Founding Fathers. Today we romanticize Ellis Island as a welcoming ward for generations of dreamers. But it was set up as an outpost of border control to weed out undesirables. In the 1880s, while Emma Lazarus was penning her sonnet, The New Colossus, now carved on the Statue of Liberty, Congress was passing the Chinese Exclusion Act to keep yellow hordes from polluting American culture and stealing American jobs. In the mid-19th century, an entire political party, the Know-Nothings, sprang from a fear of morally and racially inferior German and Irish Catholics flooding into the country. In retrospect, it's amazing that nativists of past eras repeatedly warned that we didn't have room to absorb the waves of Irish, Italian, German, Polish, Jewish, and Asian immigrants, and that their arrival would destroy America's white culture. Unfortunately, our national motto has always been, after me, no more, please. This from the United Kingdom, squandering our gains in Afghanistan. The British pullout from Afghanistan was a betrayal of our Afghan allies and our own troops, said Kenny Farquharson. Last week, we heard news that Musa Qala, a town wrested from the Taliban by British troops, had fallen to them again. When I was embedded with British forces there in 2008, the Taliban displayed the severed heads of local men they considered collaborators in the town center. I can't help but wonder how many of the Afghans I met will now suffer a similar fate, and whether the 20 British soldiers who died fighting there did so in vain. It's clear that Prime Minister David Cameron's decision to withdraw UK combat troops last year reflected public will, but that makes it no less shameful. Afghanistan went from having 150,000 international troops to just 12,000 this year, and Afghan forces weren't ready to fill the void. The resulting Taliban resurgence shows the terrible waste of our and our allies' efforts. Britain's involvement in Iraq was a disaster, but our Afghan campaign didn't have to be. Had we held on a little longer, we could have cleared a space for a new democracy to take root. Our abandonment of the field leaves a stench worse than a dead dog left out to rot in the Afghan sun. And from Israel, opposing the Iran deal is pointless. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu was right to oppose President Obama's Iran deal, said Ben Dror Yemeni. But he is wrong to continue opposing it. Does that sound counterintuitive? The key lies in the difference between being right and being smart. The Iran deal was a capitulation by a democratic superpower to a country ruled by a small backward minority of theocrats. Iran may be set back slightly in its nuclear efforts, but it is not thwarted entirely. It will continue sponsoring terrorist groups and holding rallies where mobs shout, "Death to America, death to Israel." But to continue to call for the U.S. Congress to block the deal is pointless, because other Western countries have already lifted their sanctions and are sending trade delegations to meet with the regime. The money is flowing. Recruiting Democratic senators to vote against the deal won't hurt Iran, but will divide American Jewry. At this point, Netanyahu needs to let go of his ego and consider Israel's national interest. The deal is bad, but given that it's done, we need to cooperate with the American administration to minimize the damage. Instead, Netanyahu is pushing the diplomatic crisis between Israel and the U.S. to a place of unfathomable hostility. Turn now to the last word. The seventh day of life. As death approaches, said Oliver Sacks, my thoughts turn to the peace symbolized by the Sabbath. My mother and her 17 brothers and sisters had an Orthodox upbringing. All photographs of their father showed him wearing a yarmulke, and I was told that he woke up if it fell off during the night. My father, too, came from an Orthodox background. Both my parents were very conscious of the fourth commandment, remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy, and the Sabbath, Shabbos as we called it in our Litvak way, was entirely different from the rest of the week. No work was allowed, no driving, no use of the telephone. It was forbidden to switch on a light or a stove. Being physicians, my parents made exceptions. They could not take the phone off the hook or completely avoid driving. They had to be available. if necessary, to see patients or operate or deliver babies. We lived in a fairly Orthodox Jewish community in Cricklewood in northwest London. The butcher, the baker, the grocer, the greengrocer, the fishmonger all closed their shops in good time for the Shabbos and did not open their shutters till Sunday morning. All of them, and all of our neighbors, we imagined, were celebrating Shabbos in much the same fashion as we did. Around midday on Friday, my mother doffed her surgical identity and attire and devoted herself to making Jeff-like fish and other delicacies for Shabbos. Just before evening fell, she would light the ritual candles, cupping their flames with her hands and murmuring a prayer. We would all put on clean, fresh Shabbos clothes and gather for the first meal of the Sabbath, the evening meal. My father would lift his silver wine cup and chant the blessings and the Kiddush, and after the meal he would lead us all in chanting the grace. On Saturday mornings, my three brothers and I trailed our parents to Cricklewood Synagogue on Walm Lane, a huge shul built in the 1930s to accommodate part of the exodus of Jews from the East End to Cricklewood. The shul was always full during my boyhood, and we all had our assigned seats. The men downstairs and the women, my mother, various aunts and cousins, upstairs. As a little boy, I sometimes waved to them during the service. Though I could not understand the Hebrew in the prayer book, I loved its sound and especially hearing the old medieval prayers sung, led by our wonderfully musical Hazan, or cantor. All of us met and mingled outside the synagogue after the service, and we would usually walk to the house of my Auntie Flory and her three children to say a Kiddush, accompanied by a sweet red wine and honey cakes, just enough to stimulate our appetites for lunch. After a cold lunch at home, gefilte fish, or gefilte fish, poached salmon, beetroot jelly, Saturday afternoons, if not interrupted by emergency medical calls from my parents, would be devoted to family visits. Uncles and aunts and cousins would visit us for tea, or we them. We all lived within walking distance of one another. The Second World War decimated our Jewish community in Cricklewood, and the Jewish community in England as a whole was to lose thousands of people in the post-war years. Many Jews, including cousins of mine, immigrated to Israel. Others went to Australia, Canada, or the States. My eldest brother, Marcus, went to Australia in 1950. Many of those who stayed assimilated and adopted diluted, attenuated forms of Judaism. Our synagogue, which would be packed to capacity when I was a child, grew emptier by the year. I chanted my bar mitzvah portion in 1946 to a relatively full synagogue, including several dozen of my relatives. But this, for me, was the end of formal Jewish practice. I did not embrace the ritual duties of a Jewish adult, praying every day, putting on the tefillin before prayer each weekday morning, and I gradually became more indifferent to the beliefs and habits of my parents, though there was no particular point of rupture until I was 18. It was then that my father, inquiring into my sexual feelings, compelled me to admit that I liked boys. "I haven't done anything," I said, "it's just a feeling. But don't tell Ma, she won't be able to take it." He did tell her, and the next morning she came down with a look of horror on her face and shrieked at me, "You are an abomination. I wish you had never been born." She was no doubt thinking of the verse in Leviticus that reads, "If a man also lie with mankind, as he lieth with a woman, both of them have committed an abomination. They shall surely be put to death. Their blood shall be upon them." The matter was never mentioned again, but her harsh words made me hate religion's capacity for bigotry and cruelty. After I qualified as a doctor in 1960, I removed myself abruptly from England and what family and community I had there, and went to the New World, where I knew nobody. When I moved to Los Angeles, I found a sort of community among the weightlifters on Muscle Beach and with my fellow neurology residents at UCLA. But I craved some deeper connection, meaning in my life, and it was the absence of this, I think, that drew me into near-suicidal addiction to amphetamines in the 1960s. Recovery started slowly when I found meaningful work in New York. In a chronic care hospital in the Bronx, the Mount Carmel, I wrote about in Awakenings, I was fascinated by my patients there, cared for them deeply, and felt something of a mission to tell their stories, stories of situations virtually unknown, almost unimaginable to the general public and, indeed, to many of my colleagues. I had discovered my vocation, and this I pursued doggedly, single-mindedly, with little encouragement from my colleagues. Almost unconsciously, I became a storyteller at a time when medical narrative was almost extinct. This did not dissuade me, for I felt my roots lay in the great neurological case histories of the 19th century, and I was encouraged here by the great Russian neuropsychologist A.R. Luria. It was a lonely but deeply satisfying, almost monkish existence that I was to lead for many years. During the 1990s, I came to know a cousin and contemporary of mine, Robert John Allman, a man of remarkable appearance with his robust athletic build and long white beard that made him, even at 60, look like an ancient sage. He is a man of great intellectual power, but also of great human warmth and tenderness and deep religious commitment. Commitment, indeed, is one of his favorite words. Although, in his work, he stands for rationality in economics and human affairs, there is no conflict for him between reason and faith. He insisted I have a mezuzah on my door and brought me one from Israel. "I know you don't believe," he said, "but you should have one anyhow." I didn't argue. In a remarkable 2004 interview, Robert John spoke of his lifelong work in mathematics and game theory, but also of his family, how he would go skiing and mountaineering with some of his nearly 30 children and grandchildren, a kosher cook carrying saucepans would accompany them, and the importance of the Sabbath to him. "The observance of the Sabbath is extremely beautiful," he said, "and is impossible without being religious. It is not even a question of improving society. It is about improving one's own quality of life." In December 2005, Robert John received a Nobel Prize for his 50 years of fundamental work in economics. He was not entirely an easy guest for the Nobel Committee, for he went to Stockholm with his family, including many of those children and grandchildren, and all had to have special kosher plates, utensils, and food, and special formal clothes, with no biblically forbidden admixture of wool and linen. That same month, I was found to have cancer in one eye. And while I was in the hospital for treatment the following month, Robert John visited. He was full of entertaining stories about the Nobel Prize and the ceremony in Stockholm, but made a point of saying that, had he been compelled to travel to Stockholm on a Saturday, he would have refused the prize. His commitment to the Sabbath, its utter peacefulness and remoteness from worldly concerns, would have trumped even a Nobel. In 1955, as a 22-year-old, I went to Israel for several months to work on a kibbutz. And though I enjoyed it, I decided not to go again. Even though so many of my cousins had moved there, the politics of the Middle East disturbed me, and I suspected I would be out of place in a deeply religious society. But in the spring of 2014, hearing that my cousin Marjorie, a physician who had been a protege of my mother's and had worked in the field of medicine till the age of 98, was nearing death, I phoned her in Jerusalem to say farewell. Her voice was unexpectedly strong and resonant, with an accent very much like my mother's. "I don't intend to die now," she said. "I will be having my 100th birthday on June 18th. Will you come?" I said, "Yes, of course." When I hung up, I realized that in a few seconds I had reversed a decision of almost 60 years. It was purely a family visit. I celebrated Marjorie's 100th with her and the extended family. I saw two other cousins dear to me in my London days, innumerable second and removed cousins, and, of course, Robert John. I felt embraced by my family in a way I had not known since childhood. I had felt a little fearful visiting my Orthodox family with my lover, Billy. My mother's words still echoed in my mind. But Billy, too, was warmly received. How profoundly attitudes had changed, even among the Orthodox, was made clear by Robert John when he invited Billy and me to join him and his family at their opening Sabbath meal. The peace of the Sabbath, of a stopped world, a time outside time, was palpable, infusing everything, and I found myself drenched with a wistfulness, something akin to nostalgia, wondering what if A and B and C had been different? What sort of person might I have been? What sort of life might I have lived? In December 2014, I completed my memoir, On the Move, and gave that manuscript to my publisher, not dreaming that days later I would learn that I had metastatic cancer, coming from the melanoma I'd had on my eye 9 years earlier. I'm glad I was able to complete my memoir without knowing this, and that I had been able, for the first time in my life, to make a full and frank declaration of my sexuality, facing the world openly, with no more guilty secrets locked up inside me. In February, I felt I had to be equally open about my cancer and facing death. I was in the hospital when my essay on this, My Own Life, was published. In July, I wrote another piece, My Periodic Table, in which the physical cosmos and the elements I loved took on lives of their own. And now, weak, short of breath, my once firm muscles melted away by cancer, I find my thoughts increasingly not on the supernatural or spiritual, but on what is meant by living a good and worthwhile life, achieving a sense of peace within oneself. I find my thoughts drifting to the Sabbath, the day of rest, the seventh day of the week, and perhaps the seventh day of one's life as well, when one can feel that one's work is done, and one may, in good conscience, rest. Sabbath by Oliver Sacks, originally published in the New York Times. And not coincidentally, I'm sure, we will follow that with Mr. Sacks' obituary. The neurologist and author who explored the human mind, Oliver Sacks, 1933 to 2015. Neurologist Oliver Sacks was early in his fourth decade tenure at New York City's Beth Abraham Hospital in 1969 when he encountered Miss R. She was one of about 80 patients at the Bronx facility who had survived a post-World War encephalitis epidemic, only to be left in a sleep-like state by the disease. But when Sacks administered an experimental drug, Miss R. miraculously awoke and was able to walk, talk, and even play piano. The other patients also responded, but all suffered intolerable side effects, and Sacks was eventually forced to stop the treatment, sending them back into a catatonic state. Sacks recounted their case histories in Awakenings, the 1973 bestseller that launched his career as an author of acclaimed books about people with often bizarre brain disorders, and which was made into an Oscar-nominated film in 1990. Through my patients, I would explore what it was like to be human, he wrote, to stay human in the face of unimaginable adversities and threats. Born in London to husband and wife physicians, Sachs was sent to a boarding school in the English countryside at age 6 to escape bombing raids on the capital during World War II. He was beaten and half-starved by a sadistic headmaster, said the Times, and returned home traumatized at age 10, taking refuge in his basement chemistry lab. His surgeon mother sought to instill a love of anatomy in her son by performing dissections with him, said the Washington Post. An observant Orthodox Jew, she also instilled in him a sense of shame about his sexuality. When she discovered her 18-year-old son was gay, she called him an abomination. That rejection, said Sachs, haunted me for much of my life. After studying medicine at the University of Oxford, Sachs moved to the U.S. in 1960, interning at a San Francisco hospital before spending 3 years as a resident at UCLA. He became an avid weightlifter during his California years, experimented with recreational drugs, including marijuana, LSD, and amphetamines, and developed a passion for motorbikes, said the Los Angeles Times. I would be Dr. Oliver Sachs, the intern, wearing a white coat in the daytime, he said, and then when the day was over, I would take off into the night and go for long, crazy, moonlit rides. Settling in New York, Sachs began treating the patients who would populate what he called his neurological novels. His 1985 book, The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat, introduced the world to Dr. P., the titular man whose brain had lost the ability to decipher what his eyes were seeing, and Jimmy G., an amnesiac World War II vet stranded in 1945. But Sachs also revealed how brain disorders can sometimes bestow on patients uncanny gifts, said the New York Times. An Anthropologist on Mars, 1995, featured the case of Dr. Carl Bennett, who had Tourette's syndrome, which causes verbal outbursts and other tics. Yet Tourette's also made Bennett, a surgeon, more meticulous, more exact, the neurologist wrote. Sachs was also an avid chronicler of the mysteries of his own brain, said The Guardian, writing about his experiments with psychedelic drugs, his impairments. He suffered from prosopagnosia, or face blindness, and more recently, living with cancer. I had always liked to see myself as a naturalist or explorer, Sachs wrote in 1984. I had explored many strange neurological lands, the furthest arctics and tropics of the neurological disorder. Turn to the health and science page now. Monster El Nino brewing. As this year's massive El Nino intensifies in the Pacific Ocean, climatologists say the phenomenon may become the strongest ever recorded and could cause dramatic changes in the weather. This definitely has the potential of being the Godzilla El Nino, NASA's Bill Patzert tells LATimes.com. El Nino occurs when water in the tropical Pacific becomes unusually warm as trade winds weaken or reverse direction, altering the storm track over North America and other parts of the world. In the U.S., El Nino might bring much wetter conditions, which could be a mixed blessing. In drought-parched California, torrential rains could cause mudslides and mayhem, Patzert says, but would also bring desperately needed water to rivers and reservoirs. The record 1997-98 El Nino, for example, doubled the snowpack of the Sierra Nevada Mountains, a crucial source of the state's water supply. The eastern U.S. would see less storm activity in the Atlantic, meaning fewer hurricanes and a milder winter, with rainstorms instead of blizzards. A warm winter could also prove a boon to crops in the Midwest. An International Monetary Fund study said the 1997-98 event added $15 billion to the U.S. economy. Other areas of the globe might not fare so well. Indonesia and Australia might dry out, adversely affecting the production of coffee, soybeans, and wheat. El Nino could also cripple the Latin American fishing industry, which relies on cold water fish. For all of these reasons, Columbia University meteorologist Tony Barnston says, this is a really big deal. A universal flu vaccine. Researchers are closing in on an influenza vaccine that would offer long-term protection against all strains of the virus. Currently, health officials scramble to stay one step ahead of each year's flu virus, selecting a few predominant strains for vaccine, as millions roll up their sleeves, hoping they got it right. Losing this high-stakes guessing game can mean a lot more than 2 weeks of misery for those at special risk for flu-related complications, which kill as many as 36,000 people a year in the U.S. alone. Current flu vaccines target the head of a protein that sits on the surface of all flu viruses and helps them infect the body. This head constantly mutates, forcing immunologists to reformulate the flu vaccine every year. The interior or stem of the protein, however, is consistent across different flu strains and rarely mutates. Two research teams have designed vaccines that target this stem to produce antibodies, though both vaccines must still be tested in human clinical trials, which will take several years. This is a leap forward, John Oxford, a flu expert at the University of London, tells BBC.com. Ultimately, the hope is to get a vaccine that will cover a pandemic virus. On the Talking Points page, Bush, battered by Trump's bullying. Jeb Bush's presidential campaign appears to be in free fall, said John Cassidy in NewYorker.com. The former Florida governor has now dropped to third in the national polls, with support in just the single digits. Every week, Bush and his team seem to be walking back one of his many verbal gaffes on everything from phasing out Medicare to anchor babies. And now even his money men are getting nervous. Three top national fundraisers left the campaign last week. Frontrunner Donald Trump is making Bush seem like a wimp, said Peter Beinart in TheAtlantic.com. The billionaire businessman is bullying him almost daily, knowing full well that Bush, who has a Mexican wife and calls his children Hispanic, must be enraged by his ugly rhetoric about Mexican immigrants. But Trump has correctly calculated that Bush is too scared of upsetting the GOP's base to stick up for immigrants. So all he can say is that deporting 11.5 million Hispanics is unrealistic, thus proving Trump's claim that Bush is a weak and low-energy candidate. Belatedly, Jeb Bush has decided to fight back, said Jennifer Rubin in WashingtonPost.com. Bush released an attack ad this week, tearing Trump apart for his faux conservatism, with old clips of the real estate tycoon describing himself as very pro-choice, endorsing single-payer health care schemes and high taxes, and calling Hillary Clinton very talented. Bush never wanted to get into a food fight with Trump, said Jeremy Diamond in CNN.com. His original strategy was to stay above the fray and act as the adult in the room. But with the brash billionaire showing no signs of fading, Bush had little choice. Yes, he does, says Donald David Frum in TheAtlantic.com. Trump is hurting Bush, but he's doing even bigger damage to Bush's establishment rivals, Scott Walker and Marco Rubio, by denying them valuable attention and keeping them from building any momentum. Unlike Bush, they have thin donor support, and if Trump continues to dominate, their campaigns could wither. Bush's smartest strategy is to lie low until the primaries in January and wait for the party to rally behind him as the only plausible alternative to Trump. Remember, Bush has many points of vulnerability, personal, familial, financial. Trump is not playing by the usual rules, and if Bush tries to take him down, the Donald may say anything to get revenge and take Jeb down with him. And a few notes as we wind down. About 14,770 people were killed as a result of workplace violence between 1992 and 2012, an average of 700 people a year. Shootings account for the vast majority of workplace homicides. A record 107,500 migrants reached Europe's borders in July, and 70,000 arrived in June. In 2014, there were only 280,000 registered arrivals over the entire year. Nearly half of this year's migrants are refugees fleeing the Syrian civil war. For the first time, more than 1 billion people, roughly one out of every seven people on Earth, logged onto Facebook in a single day last week. The membership of Ashley Madison, the adultery website that was recently hacked, is overwhelmingly male. An analysis of the leaked data reveals that at least 31.3 million of the 37 million accounts belong to men. Most of the online conversations men had with potential female hookups were actually with bots, automated computer programs set up by the company to fool them. And we'll finish with a quote from the very quotable Mark Twain. He says, "Heaven goes by favor. If it went by merit, you would stay out and your dog would go in." We've run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Fred Woodward. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. Questions or comments? Give us a call, 919-832-5138.